Welcome, everybody, to the Second Court of Appeals. We have one case scheduled this morning for oral that counsel have all checked in. So before we get started, I do want to introduce my panel, or our panel. To my left is Justice Dana Womack. To my right is Justice Wade Birdwell, and I'm Elizabeth Kerr. So without further ado, I'll ask the clerk to call the case. You may proceed. Yes, you may.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Dennis Eichelbaum, and I represent the Arlington Independent School District, William Horn, and Corey Robinson, the appellants in this matter. It appears to me that the appellees have conceded the issue with respect to the individual defendants. They have briefed, basically saying that they're entitled under 101-106 to be dismissed. And so unless the court has questions about that, I'll proceed to the other issues.
Well, do you agree that that constitutes a judicial admission of some sort, that all of the conduct that is the basis against them has in fact been adopted by the school district as its conduct for purposes of our consideration?
What I concede is that they were acting in their professional capacity as well as their official capacity for the school district. What I don't concede, of course, is that they had the authority to bind the district, which is something that will be discussed under Chapter 271.
Well, what action did you want us to take at this point with regard to the individual defendants? Because my concern when I reviewed the record was that I never saw a motion requesting their dismissal under 101.106E of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code. And while you generally had a plea to the jurisdiction, you never expressly moved for their dismissal in your prayer. You asked that the plea to the jurisdiction be granted, but you didn't file a motion with regard to their dismissal. So what action do you think we can take at the Court of Appeals now with regard to the individual defendants?
Well, three things. Number one, I believe that we did include it as a plea and bar also when we filed our plea to the jurisdiction. Now I'm going off the top of my head, but the 101-106 is a jurisdictional issue because the court doesn't have jurisdiction over these individuals once we have pled and we did file an answer. And so 101-106 should apply, and this court, I believe, can dismiss, number one, under 101-106. Second of all, I think this court can and should dismiss based upon the fact that they have immunity. The individuals have immunity from all tort claims. And the tort claims in this case, of course, are fraud, quantum merit, undue enrichment, which isn't even a cause of action, as well as promissory estoppel. Those are all tort claims, and the individuals have statutory immunity as well as good faith immunity. The statutory immunity, of course, is under the Education Code, and it requires attorney's fees be granted to them.
But with regard to the Education Code, isn't it immunity from liability, not from suit? And doesn't that need to be urged in a motion for summary judgment?
I don't believe that it does need to be urged in a motion for summary judgment if the court has no jurisdiction over those individuals, and they don't due to 101-106 also, because the statutory bar says that basically the Texas Supreme Court said that you have to be very careful when you're filing a suit. Because of the election of remedies clause, you either sue the government or you sue the individuals. If you're not careful, then what happens is you sue both. The individuals or the government can be dismissed. In this case, we're asking that the individuals be dismissed under 101-106E. And 101-106A specifically says that it's immediate. Now, I know plaintiffs have brought a case that says, well, what does immediate mean? But the reason that doesn't apply here is because in that case, there was an amended complaint that brought new causes of action. In their amended complaint, they didn't bring any new causes of action. They were the exact same ones. So when we asked for it to be dismissed, it was nothing changed, unlike in the case that they are urging, the disability service case.
But with regard to the Education Code provision, since they make a distinction between immunity from suit and immunity from liability, you don't think you needed to move for summary judgment with regard to those claims? Because I did locate a case when you were the attorney named McPherson versus Wiley, where the Waco court pointed out that distinction and that you had failed to move for a motion for summary judgment in that case. So should you have moved for motion for summary judgment, not only for the dismissal, but also for the attorney's fees, because we clearly can't assess attorney's fees at the appellate level?
No, I think what the court should do is send it back with an order indicating that they're entitled to dismissal and consideration of the attorney's fees. You should remand the case to the trial court. Because the trial court didn't even recognize that there's such thing as immunity. The court didn't look at anything. Basically, they just simply said, we're going to deny the plea to the jurisdiction.
But you don't think that could have been because you never expressly moved for dismissal? Because I've got your plea in front of me, and all you said in your plea to the jurisdiction is that you requested that the court grant the plea to the jurisdiction, sustain the special exceptions, and grant taxable costs and attorney's fees. You never expressly moved that the individuals be dismissed from the case.
I believe we did. We asked them to be dismissed through the plea to the jurisdiction, based upon jurisdiction. Okay. With regard to, does the court have any questions with regard to the immunity issues other than that?
I want to jump off of that for a second. It seems to me that the summary judgment requirement is important here, not necessarily with regard to the motion itself, but with regard to the relief you're requesting from us is a judgment of dismissal based upon immunity, period, okay? But you've peppered your brief with statements to us, arguably to think that, in fact, the school district intends to do this, but do it gratuitously, that, well, we're going to pay them, but actually, in terms of our actual official position, we want immunity from having to pay them for anything they did for us, because none of the claims they've actually brought have any legal binding, you know, are not legally binding on us whatsoever. So even though we've done all of these things as indicated in the record to obtain their services, got the services completed, we're actually immune from having to pay for any of that stuff. But just to make sure that it doesn't sound too harsh, we're going to go ahead and say that, well, we're going to pay them something at some point in time. So I need to confirm that what you're asking for is for us to say that the school district does not owe RJ Construction anything at this point in time and never will. That's what you're asking for. Is that correct?
No, Your Honor, actually,
okay,
that's
then
not
correct. Where did you make that in your prayer to us with regard to an alternative remedy, and how are we even – based upon your arguments in any position to provide an alternative remedy other than applying immunity or not applying immunity?
If I may.
Sure.
First of all, you're asking to me two different questions. One of them is, are you going to actually pay? And, you know, where does that come from? And the second one is, what are we asking for in relief today? Now, the question about whether we're going to pay gratuitously or whatever is outside the record, but we actually have paid
that's
them.
That's not outside the record. Oh. You've put it in your brief. You've made representations to this court about what you're willing to do.
And we have paid them. We've paid them over $175,000. That's not in the record. That's the part I'm saying is not in the record. My response to you is in explanation. That's an aside. What we're here today for, though, Your Honor, is whether or not there is a waiver of Chapter 271 and whether or not we are entitled to immunity and whether or not they have shown an affirmative demonstration of a waiver of immunity.
But there are consequences for the immunity. You're representing to the court that you're not, if we give you the judgment you're asking for, dismissal, period, immunity, a finding of that you're not going to take that as a res judicata or collateral estoppel if they try and come back with some other suit? Seriously?
No,
you're asking for a judgment.
We are
asking take for nothing. This is a take nothing judgment based upon immunity, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. That's all I wanted to confirm.
I'm sorry. I misunderstood your question then.
So I'm just curious, as a practical matter,
yes,
in an emergency situation, why would any contractor in their right mind jump in right away and start doing any work for the AISD.
Well, that's a business judgment call, Your Honor. And there were at least a dozen other contractors that did and were paid. Again, outside the record.
Were they paid without a pre-existing written contract executed in accordance with the local government code?
Your Honor, I can't tell you whether or not each one of them had a contract or had to get ratified. I don't know the answer to that question. Or if their bills came under $50,000 and they were already approved vendors, because there are other ways in which the district could have paid, depending on the amount, the value of the services for those other contractors. But in this case, the Texas Supreme Court last month again said that it's the plaintiff's burden to affirmatively demonstrate that there was a waiver, and that was in the Motson case. And so the burden is on the plaintiff to actually show that there is a waiver under Chapter 271. And if you look at Chapter 271, they have to be able to show there's a written contract, that there was a meeting of the minds, essential terms, and it was properly executed. There are emails going back and forth, but there's never a meeting of the minds. There's never an agreement that this is an amount that we're willing to pay. And one of the essential terms has to be the value of the services that the parties agree upon. And what you have is an email from Mr. Jordan saying, here's what we're proposing. And he uses the word propose. It's very clear that nowhere in the record is there ever a time where Arlington ISD, anyone from Arlington ISD, says, we agree to that amount and we will pay that amount.
Actually, why doesn't Mr. Horn do that when he asks for the proposal? The email that he actually sent asking for the proposal says, send me a proposal and we'll get this done. That's a reasonable inference of that information. And that's why Mr. Jordan, when he sends the proposal, says, is this sufficient? In other words, have I met the condition
right
of your acceptance of my of our agreement? That's and then we get a statement that, well, we're going to make it a ratification agenda item. Last time I checked, ratification is ratification isn't coming up with a new agreement. Ratification is coming up with an existing agreement. So why should we not infer from the record that, in fact, there was an agreement between the administration and between RJ Construction, okay? And then why can we not determine that the motion that was done, which authorized, just happened to authorize the superintendent to negotiate for a maximum of the exact amount that was part of the agreement, how do school districts ratify without meeting the 271 requirements?
Well, a ratification would meet the 271 requirement. They didn't ratify. The board voted.
You're saying that the ratification still has to come in writing, et cetera. It cannot be ratified by conduct in any way, shape, or form.
By a board vote, but there wasn't a board vote, and they're the only ones who have the authority to make that decision and to bind the district. If you look at the Sherryland case is the one that says you can't do it by conduct. And that's been the law for this court and all of Texas for over 10 years, that you can't waive by conduct Chapter 271 and the different requirements. Now, the properly executed portion of the requirements, there was a case that we cited where the superintendent actually signed a lease and then had it notarized, and the board had still not approved it, and the court held that that was not sufficient, that the board had to approve it. Now, in this case, what you had was it was going before the board, and the superintendent has been given the authority, and when there is justification for whatever amount that is, the superintendent intends to pay. So far, we've had justification for $175,000, so we've paid that. If the point was that if Mr. Jordan is able to bring the evidence that shows that the proper amount should be this higher amount, then the superintendent has been authorized now in the future to do that. But as of right now, the board has not authorized it. And so the board has just given the superintendent the authority, and the superintendent has not utilized that authority other than the $175,000 that I mentioned earlier.
So what I know that there was talk at the hearing in the trial court about it sounded like everybody wanted to go mediate. So
well, okay. So the mediation came from me, mm-hmm. and what I said was that we don't want to have to run, because I know mediation can take a while, I don't want to risk this court. If this court rules on the plea to the jurisdiction, then we're going on appeal. But if this court will abate, is what I said, if you'll hold off on ruling on that, with the possibility that they're going to be dismissed and all that, then I'll go to mediation, because at least the plaintiff will then come in good faith knowing there's a possibility he's going to be dismissed. And so I said, but if you rule on it, we're going to go to court and, you know, we're going to continue on and argue our case. And we wanted the individuals, because they never should have been in this case, to be dismissed. And they refused to do that.
Can we do the same thing, theoretically?
This court can do whatever it wants. And I respect
that.
That's not actually your argument.
No, I'd rather you not. I'd rather you apply the law and dismiss the case.
So are you're opposed to mediation still at this point?
We have said repeatedly that if they'll dismiss the individuals, we'll go to mediation at any time. And they have said multiple times that there's really no reason to have the individuals in, and we keep saying, let them out, and we'll go to mediation anytime.
Now, does letting them out come with the string that you also want RJ Construction to pay the individual's attorney's fees under the education code?
We didn't actually make that demand at that time.
Would you make it now?
I'd have to talk to my clients. I'm not opposed to it, Your Honor. I'm simply saying I'd have to ask my clients.
I understand. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I would like to begin by addressing the El Paso Education Initiative case that Mr. Eichelbaum just brought up. And it illustrates just how different this case is and how peculiar this case is. The El Paso case does not help the AISD at all. If you look at that case, this is a contract that is negotiated in a non-emergency situation. It's a lease agreement where it's not an emergency. And so that right there makes a huge difference in this case, because his arguments with regard to authority boil down to these guys did not have the authority, but the El Paso education case has very specific rules for charter schools that don't apply in this case. The rules that apply in this case, the statute that applies in this case, is the Texas Education Code 44.0312 and 44.031 subparagraph H, both of which allow AISD to do exactly what it did in this situation,
But doesn't 44.031H of the Education Code require a board of trustees to approve it? I mean, I don't read that section as allowing, like a school principal, for example, to say, hey, it's an emergency, we're going to do this. Doesn't the board have to do something ahead of time?
Your Honor, we have pled that they did clothe both Horn and Robinson with the authority.
But by virtue of something other than the fact that Horn and Robinson were having conversations with your client?
And claimed that they had authority. They said that. They claimed to have authority. They acted in such a way as they were clothed with authority.
Can actual authority, apparent authority, bootstrap itself into a waiver of immunity?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe it can. I think the law is that apparent authority is not enough. But in this situation, with a completed performance of the contract, with them giving full reign of Sam Houston High School and standing by, and both Horn and Robinson, as well as the school board, standing by and watching Mr. Jordan's company do the job that it was hired to do. And to your point, Justice Birdwell, when he brings the ratification, I think that is additional evidence that he had board authority to do exactly what he has done. That's the reason why he was able to promise a full payment.
Well, how is that he had authority to do it as opposed to he had made the agreement? Obviously, ratification and identifying it as a ratification item indicates there's something to be ratified, okay?
Yes, sir.
Something to be ratified.
Yes, sir.
It's already in place.
Yes, sir.
Okay? But that also is the conundrum here, which is he's still having to go ask for the ratification vote. Okay, and so the only thing I'd like you to work me through is you've identified in your brief a policy that AISD has that is some form of authority for administration to act in emergency circumstances, okay? And one of the emails from either Horner or Robinson, I cannot remember, specifically references an emergency purchase order. Is that a thing? Is there something in the policies of Arlington ISD that says, okay, under certain circumstances, you can authorize this through an emergency purchase order? Or does literally the policy still have to go back to the board for a final vote regardless of whatever?
The pleading quotes an AISD policy that tracks the Texas statute that allows the board to, in an emergency situation, to basically abandon the strictures that are normally.
But how do they do that? Okay, that's the question here: is how do they do that? Does the board just simply say you can do this? Does the administrator have to call up each member of the board and say, are you okay with this? Does there have to be something in writing still under the circumstances? It may track the statute, but that policy clearly says the board may do something, but it doesn't specifically say how the board may do it. So how are we to interpret that provision along with the statute with regard to whether or not the board did something here or the school board did something here in a manner that is contemplated by that statute that authorized the emergency purchase order?
I cannot answer that question, Your Honor. It's not in the pleading. And at this early stage in the litigation, I think that would be an issue of discovery. I do not have that policy in front of me. Now, I would point the court to Texas Education Code 44.0312 that in an emergency situation, the board can delegate to superintendent or other designated person the authority to contract for the replacement, construction, or repair of school equipment or facilities if the emergency replacement, construction, or repair is necessary for the health and safety of district students and staff. It does not require a specific board vote in this particular statute. The governing documents of AISD may or may not. I really don't know.
Nope. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Nope. Yeah, because I'd be interested to get your view on how we are to construe the actual language and whether you think it's ambiguous, because AISD policy provision that you quote in your pleading says, you know, if there's an emergency and a board determines that delay would mess things up, then contracts can be made other than by those in the education code. Now, do you read that as saying that the board has to determine that first, or that it can retroactively go back and go, yeah, this was an emergency?
I believe it has to mean that it retroactively can go back. Otherwise, and the other thing is, I think the board can meet on an emergency basis and outside of the Texas Open Meetings Act and still comply with the Texas Open Meetings Act in an emergency situation, which this clearly was. I mean, it was a fluid situation. And
literally.
It was. I mean, a fluid situation. But the other thing is that if you look at the emails that were provided to Jordan, I mean, Mr. Horn says administration has the authority to engage your company for emergency services and then work through the official approval process. But it has the authority to contract with RJ Construction. What Mr. Horn is saying is you're not on the normal approved contractor list, but I'm going to get that fixed right as soon as I can, and it will be fixed. That's why he was able to promise that full payment will be made. Full payment will be made. March 11, full payment will be made. They accepted the complete performance of RJ Construction, of Jordan's work at Sam Houston High School.
Do you have any authority that you can cite with regard to what you just said, which is the accepting the full performance, that somehow takes it out of the written contract?
I would cite the court to Clear Creek Independent School District versus Cotton, that's a Houston Court of Appeals opinion, 529 Southwest 3rd.
It's a hurricane case, right?
Yes, sir. And Fisher versus CTMI LLC, Supreme Court case, 479 Southwest 3rd, 231. And if you look at those cases, past performance under an agreement may remove uncertainty and establish that a contract enforceable as a bargain has been formed.
And Clear Creek actually does talk about pleadings from the school district establishing some degree of authority. And so is there anything with regard to the pleadings here? Again, I mentioned earlier about, well, we're going to pay them. We've agreed to pay them. We just don't know what we're going to pay them. Is there anything that is triggered by Clear Creek with regard to that?
I believe that that constitutes an admission on the part of the school district that there was an enforceable contract and they owe under the contract. Because if, and you raised this point a minute ago, if this court does what the school district is asking it to do and dismisses this case with prejudice, the school district will have no legal duty to pay Jordan a penny. We'll have no legal duty to pay Jordan a penny. So if the school district paid Jordan under that circumstance, I think it would violate the Texas Constitution's gift clause. A governmental unit can't simply pay someone money unless there's a legal reason to do so. And so I think there's a huge problem with saying the case is dismissed with prejudice, you owe them nothing, and then trusting them to pay us something.
Could the board theoretically come to some sort of terms with your client and then create a contract and backdate it and pay them legally that way?
I think after a court has dismissed this case,
I'm talking about as things are today.
I believe they can enter into a settlement agreement. I absolutely believe they can enter into a settlement agreement. So I think that they have the authority to do that. But again, as Justice Birdwell pointed out, this notion of we are price gouging, we exceeded the scope of the work product, all of those types of comments came after they had accepted the complete performance of Jordan and actually go to the merits of the case. What we are trying to do is test AISD's claim of price gouging and whatever other defenses in front of a jury, not use as an excuse to go ahead and dismiss this case because RJ Construction's kind of a bad player anyway. I mean, if this court's going to dismiss this case with prejudice, it's going to do so because it did not find that these emails constituted a contract and constitute evidence of a contract. At least our pleading is insufficient on that point, which I believe that is not true. I believe our pleading is more than sufficient on that point, and or the court will not go out and find that there's been a waiver by conduct or somehow redefine governmental immunity in this context not applying, and it's because there's insurance dollars at play. So again, I don't want to wait off into that just yet, but I think that the pleading.
Are you arguing that we should be able to look at the Chapter 44 provisions, and because the board still has to make a determination that delay would be bad, okay? So that's an active verb. The board still is the party that has to determine there's a delay that justifies, okay?
Yes, sir.
Has any court dealt with whether or not that determination can be made outside the context of Chapter 271 possibly with regard to conduct?
The honest answer for me is I don't know.
You don't know. Okay. That would be the honest answer because I didn't find it either. But
okay, I'm glad we agree on that part.
All right.
So I think that, and with regard to Justice Womack, with regard to the individual defendants, I do want to touch on that just very briefly because I do think that they have made a judicial admission by moving for their dismissal. And I think that they didn't title their motion very well, and they hid the motion in their brief to the court that was filed. But at least if you look at footnote 5 of our brief, we do say that acknowledge that there was a two-sentence request in their brief to the trial court requesting that the individuals be dismissed under the Texas Tort Claims Act 101.106E. And we have taken the position in that footnote, just to be completely candid with the court, that we did not take the position at the trial court that that motion was somehow insufficient. We don't take that position before this court. In that brief, he definitely has these two sentences requesting that Horn and Robinson be dismissed under 101.106E, and he did raise that during the hearing. During the discussion of the mediation in particular, go ahead and dismiss Horn and Robinson and then don't rule on the plea to the jurisdiction and send us to mediation. I think he argued it in that portion.
With regard to that, then, with regard to Mr. Horn and Mr. Robinson, you say in your appellate brief that AISD's motion necessarily requires Horn and Robinson to be dismissed from the case immediately. Why didn't you non-suit them at the trial court if you're admitting they should be dismissed and you're now acknowledging that the brief was sufficient to raise the issue? Why didn't you do that at the trial court?
I want the judicial admission that Horn and Robinson, all of their conduct was within the course and scope of their employment. I wanted to
make that judicial admission argument at the trial court, or is that a new argument you're making here for us to to find a judicial admission?
That is a new argument that I'm making here. That is a new argument that I'm making here. I did not argue against his motion to dismiss under the Texas Tort Claims Act. I just sat there. And the hearing was rather chaotic. It had a number of issues, and it had sort of a life of its own. And the trial court ended up just denying everything, and I was along for the ride at that point. And so I didn't say anything. But
of course, as I think Justice Birdwell alluded to earlier, just because Horn and Robinson were acting within the scope of their employment doesn't necessarily compel a determination that a 271 contract was entered into, correct?
I think that it does because of the way that the Tort Claims Act defines scope of employment, so the performance for a governmental unit of the duties of an employee's office or employment and includes being in or about the performance of a task lawfully assigned to an employee by competent authority. And so I think the lawfully assigned to an employee by competent authority bridges any gap with regard to whether they had the authority to do what they did. I think that this is a retroactive, by moving for the dismissal of these gentlemen, they have essentially adopted what they did, which is to enter into a procurement agreement. Yes, ma'am.
If we were to agree with that, would that not run the risk of opening up the door to a waiver by conduct argument in any case where there's work done for a local government entity, but there wasn't, strictly speaking, a
judicial admission, and which will prevent us from thereafter claiming that they did not have the authority to do what they did, because authority comes within scope of employment.
Let me make a distinction here. That's the facilitation of immunity to employees under the Tort Claims Act. Could it also be a judicial admission with regard to just pleading? In other words, if a school district comes in and says, well, yes, Mr. Horn had authority to do what he was doing, et cetera, but because they don't get to turn around and say, but we never signed a contract, so even though we admit that here, we're still out on immunity. So I guess that's not well articulated, but bottom line is, as you're saying, the function of 101-106 in their employing 101-106 is a judicial admission in itself, but their pleading to effectuate that also constitutes a judicial admission.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that once they move for dismissal, then which is automatic, requires their dismissal, they have judicially admitted these facts. And I think these facts, if I'm understanding your question, are judicially admitted regardless.
Well, presumably, counsel would not.
To make emergency contracts. Your Honor, you brought that up, and you said, well, you know, just because the law says they can do it, did they ever do it? The burden is on the plaintiff to show that they actually did it, and they hadn't done it.
Let me hypothetically do this then. If, in fact, the determination in an emergency circumstance doesn't require an actual board meeting, okay,
mm-hmm.
And then we have a statement that the board, that I am authorized to enter into this contract with you under emergency circumstances, and here's what I need in order to pay you what you've asked to be paid, is I need a proposal from you, and if you give me the proposal, then I'll go ahead and make sure you get paid, okay, which appears to be a contract, and then the ratification language is used later. That's what I'm trying to figure out, is if anybody's ever actually dealt with how, in fact, a school district or any other governmental entity operates in an emergency circumstance.
Yes.
When maybe they can't meet, or maybe maybe some member is missing or whatever. Okay.
Understood. So the answer is there are emergency circumstances for having emergency meetings, et cetera, to be able to address those things. But school boards, and many school boards have already done this, school boards have the authority under the education code to grant authority to the superintendent in emergency situations, and they typically in those policies define an emergency, in those circumstances to make unbudgeted purchases, and they usually say a specific amount. Arlington doesn't have such a policy, but there are school boards that do have that kind of policy. And so there is something in the law where it could be done if they chose to do it. That was never done. And I think it was a good analogy of, well, if a teacher says, hey, this is an emergency, I need you to send me this, this, and this from Office Depot, that does not bind the school district.
Well, we're not talking about a teacher doing something. We're talking about 450,000 square feet of water and mold, black mold problems, which would wipe out the ability to use the high school, and then you have to distribute all of those students to your other high schools and all of the cost attendant to all of that. So we're dealing with real emergency here.
Yes, Your Honor, and we are bound by the pleadings. We don't necessarily agree that the scope of what you described. That's correct. I understand.
Mold is specifically mentioned in the...
Well, there's the potential of mold.
In the ratification item that was being presented to the board. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. I was referring more to the 450,000 square feet, but that's not really important for this.
Forget about that. The bottom line is there's moisture. It could present mold, et cetera.
Right. Okay. But it's important to understand that throughout all of this, every communication back and forth, there's never an agreement by Horn or Robinson as to that is the proper amount that should be paid. It doesn't exist. There's nothing. Never does Horn or Robinson say, yes, that's a correct amount and we'll take care of that or anything like that.
Why did the board put that exact amount in its motion after it rejected the agreement that was being presented for ratification? Did the agreement being presented for ratification not have that amount in it?
The invoice, the proposed invoice, did have that amount in it, and so what happened was the board looked at that and said, there is no justification for that amount. However, we are going to authorize the superintendent to work with RJ Construction and determine what is the appropriate amount, and it cannot exceed, and they had to have some number, so they took the number that RJ Construction claims that they can justify, and so they said, that's the maximum that you're authorized to spend on this matter, but if he doesn't justify it, then don't pay that amount. Pay what was justified. And so that's why they did that. Thank you. I believe my time is up. Are there any other questions?
Anything else? All right.
Thank you
very much. Your case is submitted. The oral argument has been very helpful. We appreciate it very much. And with that, we will be adjourned.